If you would take your Bibles to Genesis chapter 10 this morning, we're going to start with this passage that's often called the Table of the Nations. And I want to distribute a map that kind of shows, by the way, I will say that there's some guesswork in this map. It's not my map. I found it on this website, BibleHistory.com. I will say that there's some guesswork because any respectable scholar will say that many of these names, we don't know where these people ended up. The names have been changed over time in what often is called the Christian era. A lot of these nations don't go by these names anymore, and there's been migration. So we don't know where all of these have ended up. But it's a good, this man has given a shot at showing where these families and these nations were distributed. So just as we walk through Genesis chapter 10 this morning, hopefully it's something that can be a little bit of a guide and helpful. So let's go ahead and jump in, and we're not going to spend all of our time this morning in Genesis chapter 10, but we'll start there. It shows the generations of Noah through Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and they spread out. They had lots of children. I will also say this, that what's recorded in Genesis 10 is not all of the sons. It's all the sons of Noah, but it's not all of the sons of their children and their grandchildren. You'll see this, that it's kind of traces. There are 70 here that are mentioned, and some give a lot of credence to that number 70. I'm not a big numerology guy, but I will say that there are 70 nations that are here mentioned. So let's walk through. Let's start by reading Genesis chapter 10, verses 1 through 5. And this is, let me say this very quickly. It talks about the sons of Japheth, and then Ham, and then Shem. Usually when God mentions the three sons of Noah, in fact, whenever you see them all three mentioned together, it's always Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And as it divides these here, it goes in backwards order. It says Japheth, Ham, and Shem. Why does it do that? Maybe the best answer that I've heard is that they're by order of, not importance necessarily, but order of proximity to and importance to the land, to the nation of Israel. The rest of the book of Genesis, starting in chapter 12, is going to be zeroing in, focusing on Abraham and his family. And so the tribe of the families of Japheth, because of where they ended up dispersing, because of where they ended up settling, they had the least to do with the children of Israel. And then the children of Ham, they had more to do in a bad way. Most of the children of Ham that we'll look at ended up becoming the enemies, some of the arch enemies of Israel throughout their time, the Canaanites and so forth. And then you've got the children of Shem, which are, which one branch of the children of Shem is where Abraham comes from. And so that's maybe why the order is reversed here, to show them in reverse order of their proximity to the land of and proximity to the nation of Israel and the seed of Abraham that would come later. So let's walk through Japheth's family. Genesis 10, let's read verses 1 through 5. And the Bible makes it clear that these are, some of these are direct sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, but then some of them are more than just a person. What we're going to get into, we'll see things like, you know, we'll see the ites in here, particularly when we get to the children of Ham, that it's more, it's talking about more than just a person that was in the family tree. It's talking about families and tribes and then even nations that ended up coming from these people. So let's start Genesis chapter 10 and verse 1. It says, "Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog, and Medai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech, and Tiras. And the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, and Riphath, and Togarmah. And the sons of Javan, Elisha, and Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, and their nations." That phrase, the isles of the Gentiles, may have to do with there are many, many islands in the Mediterranean Sea and then going into the other seas near Greece and Macedonia and so forth. And that may be a reference to them. That's not the only places where these people ended up. So you'll see, if you just want to see on that chart, hopefully it's kind of self-explanatory, the color, it's color-coded for quick eye reference, as a guy I used to work with always used to say. But the what would you look like that with Japheth? Those names that are in green, they primarily went to the north, and you've got modern day Turkey and Russia and some of the other north. And then they also went out to the east. Tarshish is modern day Spain, and Javan. The name Javan is has to do with the Greek people, Greece, and then and so forth. So you kind of look over that map there, and the most of the sons of Japheth immigrated to the northern areas. This is immediate. Obviously, now we've covered the entire earth, and we're not going to spend time talking about who's gone where. But we see, we do see some of the. Let me just mention some of the names here. The there are seven nations from Japheth here in Gomer. By the way, I'll use some terms that are maybe a little bit older too, but Magog is the area of the Scythians, north of the Caspian Sea. Modern-day Russia is up there now. Medai is the Medes, where they settled south of the Caspian Sea. Javan, as I mentioned, is the Ionians or the Greeks. Javan is the Hebrew name for the Greeks, and they settled in modern-day Greece. Tubal is the Turks, and they lived south of the Black Sea there. And then Meshek is another name for the Slavs, and they lived between the Black Sea and the Caspian Seas. And then you've got Tiras. The Etruscans is another name for them at times, and they're located west of the Black Sea. And so these are the seven nations that come from Japheth. There could be more that we could say about some of these, but for sake of time, we're going to kind of keep moving on. So that those are that, that's the descendants, the sons and the grandsons, and then the nations that came from Japheth. Let's go on to verse 6 and look at, and there's some more names here recorded for the descendants of Ham. So Genesis 6, let's read Genesis 10, read down through verse 20. Verses 6 through 20 says, "And the sons of Ham, Cush and Mizraim and Phut and Canaan, and the sons of Cush, Seba and Havilah, and Sabta, and Rayama, and Sabtika, and the sons of Rayama, Sheba, and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord." What that means is it became kind of a proverb. If somebody lived in the way that was kind of like Nimrod, they would say, "Oh, you're like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord." It became a proverb that they would apply to other people. He became kind of a legend and a hero, so to speak. Verse 10, "And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calne, in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Asher, and builded Nineveh, and the city Rehoboth, and Calah. And reason between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. And Mizraim begat Ludim, and Anamim, and Lahabim, and Naphtuhim, and Pathrusim, and Casluhim, out of whom came Philistim, and Kaphtorim. And Canaan begat," so now Canaan is the fourth son of Ham, "and Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite." Here's where we see not just people, but we see tribes and nations. "And Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgasite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zimmerite, and the Hamathite, and the Stalactite, and the Stalagmite." No, I'm just kidding. I always like to say that. "And afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Zidon, as thou comest to Gerar, unto Gaza, as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim, even unto Lasha. These are the sons of Ham, after their families, after their tongues, in their countries, and in their nations." And so the people that came from Ham, let's say just real fast a couple of things, that obviously Ham was one of Noah's sons, and he had four sons that became fathers of nations that primarily migrated to Africa. You see the names, by the way, I'll say this very quickly. The name Cush is modern, is the Ethiopians. They became the Ethiopians. They settled south of Egypt. They migrated to an area north of the Persian Gulf as well. But Cush has to do with Ethiopia. Mizraim, other places in the Bible shows that it's Egypt. Mizraim is the father of the Egyptians. In the Bible, it's the Bible name for Egypt, settled in northeastern Africa. Phut, is the Libyans, we believe. Some people don't know for sure where the where his people migrated to, but many believe that they're the modern-day Libyans. They settled in North Africa. And then you have Canaan, and who was the father of the Canaanites that settled in the area that we know in the Bible, the land of Canaan, the land that's often called the Promised Land, is where the Canaanites, above East Africa, east of the Mediterranean Sea, that God later gave to Abraham's descendants, to the Hebrews. So those are the nations of Ham. There are some familiar names there from Ham than from Japheth. We recognize Sodom and Gomorrah as being those that the sons of Ham gave birth to. We see Gaza, where the Philistines are. We see Sidon, which is up, you know, Tyre and Sidon became famous for their rejection of God. The Canaanites, the sons of Ham primarily, become the enemies of God. They become rebellious against God. And we're going to look at in just a little while, we saw this story of Nimrod being one of the children descendants of Ham. We'll get back to Nimrod in just a moment. But let's look at the descendants of Shem very quickly, verses 21 through 32, and then we'll come back to Nimrod. So verse 21 says, unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. And by the way, some people believe it's kind of split on this, and we're not going to split fellowship with anyone over this, but some people believe that Eber there is where we get the name the Hebrews, that Heber is the father of the Hebrews. Some people believe that the name Hebrews comes from Abraham when he crossed over the river. The name Hebrews, some people believe, means to cross over, and that when Abraham crossed over, he became the father of the Hebrews. But it may be right here that that Shem was the father of all the children of Eber, the Hebrews later, the brother of Japheth, the elder, even to him were children born. By the way, real fast about verse 21. This is a little bit of a moot point, not a big deal. But the elder, some people say that there's three options people take. Was Shem the oldest or the youngest or what? What's the order? Is it Shem, Ham, Japheth? Is that the order of birth? And some people say that, here's how I take it. Unto Shem also, he was the father of all the children of Eber. He was the brother of Japheth, and he was the elder. With the way that the commas are in there, you can read it, the brother of Japheth the elder, like Japheth is the elder. I believe that Shem is the elder. Then you can read it as like an appositive phrase there, that Shem was the father of all the children of Eber. He was the brother of Japheth, and he was the elder. Even to him were children born. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about reasons why people debate about the ages or the order of the ages. But anyway, let's go on. Look at verse 22. The children of Shem, Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. And the children of Aram, Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash. And Arphaxad begat Selah, and Selah begat Eber. And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. By the way, what does it mean that in Peleg's day was the earth divided? People take a couple of different options. In fact, there are more options, but some people believe that the earth, the land masses in the earth were physically divided through like earthquakes or whatever, migrations of continents. Some people say, look how Africa looks like it fits together with South America. You ever notice that? It looks like it fit together like a puzzle piece at one time, and now they're thousands of miles apart. Some people believe that during the days of Peleg, the earth was divided in that way. I personally believe that it has to do with the what we're going to read in the next chapter, chapter 11, the Tower of Babel and the dispersing of the nations. So we'll get to the Tower of Babel in just a little bit. So let's go on. Look at verse 26. And Joktan begat Almodad and Sheleth and Hazarmaveth and Jerah and Hadoram and Uzal and Dikla and Obel and Abimael and Sheba and Ophir and Havilah and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. And their dwelling was from Mesha, as thou goest unto Sephar, a mount of the east. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues and their lands, after their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations and their nations. And by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. And so, by the way, it mentions there the five Semitic nations. You have Elam, which is the Persians. They settled northeast of the Persian Gulf. You have Asher, which we get the Assyrians. They come from Asher, the biblical name for Assyria. They settled between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. You have Arphaxad, which was the Babylonians came from Arphaxad, and they settled in Chaldea. You have Lud, who is often called the father of the Lydians, who settled in Asia Minor, but some of them crossed over the Mediterranean and settled in northern Africa. And then you have Aram, the father of the Syrians. And the biblical name for Syria is Aram, located north and east of Israel. And so these are the sons of Shem. I'm not going to say any more about this map. You'd like to take this map and look at it later. Or if you're totally bored with the sermon, you just want to look at the map through the rest of the sermon, you're welcome to do that. And if you want to draw on it in color, we can distribute some crayons. But I want to mention, let's go back to verses 8 through 10. It talks about this man named Nimrod, one of the descendants of Ham. It says that he became a mighty one in the earth. He became a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore, it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And it says that his kingdom started with Babel. Nimrod is the one who starts the kingdom of Babel, the city of Babel, and I believe the Tower of Babel, that Nimrod is the founder of all of that. And Nimrod, people debate about what these words mean, that he was a mighty hunter. That sounds kind of self-explanatory, right? And the word hunter is the word hunter. Somebody who would go out and hunt animals and hunt food and bring it back. And it's possible that that's the extent of what it's talking about. Some people believe it goes further than that, to say that Nimrod was a hunter of men as well, that he was a very savage man, a murderer, who would go out and do a conquest of men and bring them under his rule, that he was the first empire builder. By the way, people debate about who Nimrod was in secular history. His name is Nimrod in the Bible, but some people believe that you ever heard of Gilgamesh, the Epic of Gilgamesh? Some people believe that Nimrod was Gilgamesh. Some people believe that Nimrod was Sargon the Great of Akkad, with the early Sumerian dynasty there. I'm not going to take time to go into that. But there is an interesting parallel, if you ever know anything about the Epic of Gilgamesh. Many believe the oldest surviving story or epic of in the world. People debate wildly about when it was written. Some people say 2700 BC or 3300 BC. I don't agree with that because that was before the flood. The flood happened around 2300 BC. So it's going to be after that. Some people say about 2100, the Epic of Gilgamesh. So just in the first couple of hundred years after the flood, Gilgamesh was a fictional character that many people believe was based on a real character. But in the Epic of Gilgamesh, part of the story has to do with this. It has to do with a flood legend that Gilgamesh was kind of part man, part God, so to speak. He became a hero. He goes out and does these conquests. And one of his conquests is that he goes to fight against one of the gods. By the way, there's a lot of polytheism in their culture and in this Epic of Gilgamesh. But part of what his conquest is, he goes out to fight against the god that had sent the great flood to try to destroy him. And in the Epic of Gilgamesh, he is successful. He does confront and fight, and he defeats this god. So this culture looks at the god that sent the flood as the enemy. We need to make sure it doesn't happen again. And some people even believe that the Tower of Babel doesn't mention this angle in Genesis 11. We'll get to it in just a minute. But some people believe that the Tower of Babel was built to be so tall that if God were to flood the world again, it would rise above the flood and they would survive and they would be able to thwart this God that hates humanity. So that's the attitude of the Sumerians. And this may have been the attitude of Nimrod. He may have been primarily, and by the way, the name Nimrod has to do with rebellion. When did he receive his name? Was he rebellious as a one-year-old? And he said, man, you're a Nimrod. People debate about what the name Nimrod means, but the root has to do with rebellion. And that seems to be what he does. He makes a kingdom to gather people around himself to conquer people and lift themselves up and rebel against God. And I want to go ahead and transition to chapter 11, and we'll see the end result of his kingdom, the end result of his attitude of rebellion against God. And that is the focus of what I want to look at this morning, is man's rebellion against God. Man rebelled against God before the flood. God wiped him out. And then man rebels after the flood. But the reason God doesn't wipe them out is because he promised he wouldn't destroy them with the flood. But they deserve it just as much as the people before the flood. So let's talk about the Tower of Babel. Let's go and look at Genesis chapter 11. Let's read verses 1 through 9, and then we'll walk through the passage. It says, "And the whole earth was of one language." By the way, let me say this very quickly. I believe that the chronology is not hard and fast. You don't have all of chapter 10. They spread out across all the earth, and then you have chapter 11. I think chapter 10, by the time they all spread out in their nations, it takes a long time. And then God explains that chapter 11 happened along the way in chapter 10, if we can call it that. So look at verse 1. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. This is often, this area goes by different names. It's often called the Fertile Crescent. It's often called Mesopotamia. And they dwelt there, verse 3. And they said one to another, go to, which kind of means come. Let's get together and have this powwow. Let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. Why would they do that? Let's make bricks. Well, the area where they were, there's lots of sand. See that today. I don't know exactly what it looked like as far as the vegetation then. But it's not an area with lots of stones. A lot of times people would build things out of stones. They wanted to build a lot, but there weren't a lot of stones. So let's make brick and use that for the stones. That's why they did that. They had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. Slime is like pitch or maybe even like asphalt. It's this movable stuff that then sets up and becomes hard. Verse 4, and they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. By the way, you never see the phrase the Tower of Babel in the Bible, but the city was called Babel, and then there was a tower in it that we call the Tower of Babel. There was a city and a tower, two separate things. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded, and the Lord said, behold, the people is one. We're not going to talk about the grammar of that right now, but anyway, it's grammatically correct. The people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now, and by the way, this is not God in insecurity fearing man at all. But it's an interesting thing that he says that shows that man can accomplish some great things. Obviously, God gives him the ability. God gives him the breath, the very breath that he uses to do it. But he's saying that we can't discount where the mind of man can go. We see in our world today, the things that where man tries to play God scientifically and technologically. We're talking about stem cell this and head transplant that, and who knows what's going to end up happening. But man can accomplish some pretty amazing things, is what God is saying here. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. They could build a tower higher than you could think of and imagine. They couldn't reach to heaven, by the way. But they could do some pretty impressive things. So God says this, go to, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they leapt off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, which means confusion, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. By the way, I wondered this. When God confounded the languages, when he scattered them based on the language, did he scatter them inside their families? Like, were there fathers that didn't understand their children now? Were there husbands that didn't understand their wives? Now, that was already happening. But maybe God just left that alone. I'm going to let them say the same language because they're already on different pages. Anyway. I want to look at four elements of this story of the Tower of Babel that highlights the futility of what they were doing. Number one, I want to look at the exaltation of self. Look at verse 4. The exaltation, the pride of man, the exaltation of self. It says, and they said, go to. This was why they wanted to build this. Let us build us a city. Notice the focus is on us. Let us build us. Nothing here is for God, nothing's for other people. Let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The Tower of Babel was man seeking to lift himself up against God so that he could rebel against God, so that he could disobey God, so that he didn't need God. We're gonna make a society where we are the end-all, be-all. It's all about us. There's no need for God. There is no God. There's just us. We are God. That's what's happening with the Tower of Babel. I want to look at a couple of verses that God speaks about pride. Look at Proverbs 16 and verse 18, and then we'll look at Luke 14. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18. We are told in the Bible that we are to do all things to the glory of God. By the way, it's very easy for us to look at the Tower of Babel and say, man, those guys were bad. They didn't do it to the glory of God. But how many times do we in our lives not even consider God's glory? We only think of ourselves, and we are just like these people in many ways sometimes. But here's what God says about pride, about making a name. We want to be somebody in the earth. That's what they're saying. We want to make us a name. So when people hear about us, they think, wow. We want to be famous. We want to be exalted. That's their goal. And here's what God says about that. Proverbs 16, verse 18, it says, pride goeth before destruction, and an haughty spirit before a fall. You want to find the end result of this? It always leads to pride is before destruction. Where there's pride, destruction will follow. Where there's a haughty spirit, a fall will always follow. Always. It's a hard and fast rule from God. We may not see it now. We may not see it fast. Sometimes this fall may come after death when people stand before God. But pride always ends in destruction. A haughty spirit always ends in a fall. Look at Luke chapter 14 and verse 11. And this is one thing that we see happen in this passage. Luke 14, 11. Then after this, we're going to turn to Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4 and look at a very good example of this. In fact, a very ironic example, because it's the same kingdom. Luke 14 and verse 11 says this, "For whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased, put down, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted." This is one of the things that we need in God's word to tell us, because we don't figure it out on our own. When the Bible says, "Lean not to your own understanding," it means things like this. The Bible says that down is up and up is down. It doesn't mean that the Bible's wrong. It doesn't mean that the Bible's upside down. It means that we are upside down. God says you need to reorient yourself and know that the way up is to humble yourself, and then God will lift you up. And if you want a surefire way to go down and be abased, then lift yourself up. And even do it publicly. Gather lots of people around and tell them, I want to be abased. Because that's what happens. God says, if you lift yourself up, you'll be abased. Let another man's lips praise thee. There's time for being exalted, but let other people, let God do it. You do it yourself to yourself, God will bring it low. And let's look at one of the classic examples of this. Look at Daniel chapter 4. This is King Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon when Babylon reached its zenith. When Babylon reached the peak of its powers. Nobody could touch Nebuchadnezzar except God, and God did. So look at Daniel 4 and verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar learned the hard way that humanity lifting itself up at the expense of glorifying God ends in being abased. So Daniel 4, 28, there's a lot more to this story, but we'll just read this very quickly. Verse 28 through 32. It says, "All this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power, for the honor of my majesty?" And by the way, on a human level, what he had built was very impressive. And none of us can dispute that. But God was displeased. So it says this, "While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee, and they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and 7 years shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." In another place it says that he setteth up over it the basest of men. God sets low men, humble men, even worthless men. God set anybody over. Just because you're the king of a nation doesn't mean that you're great. It means God put you there. And if we say, I'm great, then God can do this. And God did something that he doesn't do all the time. God sent him out into a field for 7 years and he lost his mind. He went insane. He couldn't talk. He, when you look at the full chapter, it says that his hair grew like eagle's feathers, and he had claws, and he ate grass like an ox, and he was a moron for 7 years. At the end of 7 years, when he repented, God gave him his kingdom back. But for these 7 years, God humbled him greatly. And I don't know if they like made a zoo exhibit and said, there's Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know what they did. But God brought him very low, and he learned this the hard way. Imagine that a two-year-old comes to you, and he's got his building blocks. You know, the building blocks, they've got the letters on them. And he builds a tower that is 1 foot tall. By the way, that'd be pretty impressive for those blocks for a two-year-old to build a tower that comes up a whole foot without falling over. He comes and says, Daddy, look what I did. Yay! And then, you know, because you don't want to make him feel bad, you're saying, wow, that's wonderful. But when he walks away, you're not like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. We've got to take a picture. We've got to put this on Facebook. We've got to call it Guinness Book of World Records. This is amazing. You're really not that impressed with what he did, right? But bless his heart, he's just a two-year-old. So that's the best that he can do. That's kind of like what the Tower of Babel was. It didn't impress God what they did. It didn't make God say, wow, let me come and see, let me applaud what you've done. It's kind of like ants building an anthill, and you just come and kick it over. And they got to start all over. But they do it, bless their hearts, and you come and kick it over again. They don't figure out. He's right there. He's just going to kick it over when we're done. They just rebuild it. That's what the Tower of Babel was. It's just ants trying to lift themselves up against God. They never threatened God, but because of their attitude, God had to kick their anthill over, so to speak. God had to bring them down. Look at Mark chapter 13. God is never impressed with the pride of man, with the accomplishments of man. You think God ever comes around and says, by the way, we mentioned this, when God says we're going to confound what they're doing, God was not threatened. God didn't say, oh no, they're going to overthrow heaven. We better do something about this. That was not the case. It was kind of a bless their heart type of moment. These guys, they think they're more than they are. God's never impressed with our works. We're lifted up with pride about it, but it never moves God. So look at Mark 13. This is God. The disciples come to God, Jesus, and they say, look at this building! And look at Jesus' response. Mark 13, verse 1. It says, and as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples saith unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. This is amazing. They've spent 46 years building this. This cornerstone is so long. It weighs so much. Wow! And Jesus says, not impressed. Look what he says. And Jesus answering said unto him, seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. It was similar. You know, this was their Tower of Babel. Now God allowed them to build the temple, but the temple became their monument to themselves and to their pride. And look who we are. And God, and we don't need God in the right way. God came and knocked over their sandcastle. And the pride of man, the accomplishments of man, never impresses God. He's not impressed with us. He gave us the ability. He knows what we can do. And we need to glorify him with what we do and never lift ourselves up. So you see there, the pride of man. We see the exaltation of self in the Tower of Babel. The second thing that we see, look at verse 6, back in Genesis 11, verse 6, is that we see misguided unity. Did you know that unity is a very good thing? But unity can be a very bad thing. Unity by itself does not please God. Sometimes people think, oh, the worst thing in this world is that people are fighting with each other. We just need people to get along. We need world peace. If people just got along, that'd be the best thing we could ever have. Well, unity, they had world peace right here. One language, they were all gathered together, and God was so displeased that he messed it up. God is not pleased with unity for unity's sake. We need to be very aware of that. So Genesis 11, 6 says this, and the Lord said, behold, the people is one. And so many people would stop there and say, what a wonderful thing. If we could only go back to when we had world peace and everybody was one. Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. And so the Tower of Babel is man unified with one purpose, with one goal. It's just that that goal displeased God. That goal was against God, in direct rebellion against God. So this was a bad unity. Look at Psalm 2. This is maybe one of the examples, one of the applications of this passage. God is pleased with unity, but he's pleased with unity according to truth. When God prayed for, in John 17, when God prayed for the church, he said that they may all be one as we are one, as Jesus and the Father are one. God is not praying for the church to be one just for one's sake. You know, it doesn't really matter what they believe as long as they believe the same thing. That is not what God wants. God only wants unity that's according to truth. If the truth is thrown out, then he wants division. He says, mark them which cause divisions, you know, according to what I've taught you, and separate from them. God is for division if the truth is at stake. God only wants unity when it's according to truth, when it's like, when it agrees with him. So look at Psalm 2:1. It says, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? This is what they were doing at the Tower of Babel. The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. So man gets together and says, let's cast off God. We don't want God's restraint. We don't want God's control. Let's get together in unity and overthrow God. And here's God's response. Look at verse 4. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. And so they gather together and they say, let's overthrow God. And God laughs. You can't. They can't touch God in heaven. It's like a man. My dad is a preacher, and he's preached this verse. He often uses this as an illustration. He preaches in youth camps, and he'll call up and try to find the smallest boy that he can see there. Come on up here, young man. And he puts his hand on the little boy's head, and he says, now I want you to hit me as hard as you can. Hit me in the chest. And this little boy's like, you know, come on. And he can't reach him. And that's what it's like. One time my dad called up a guy that was actually a lot taller than he thought he was. Taller than him. And he's like, all right, come on, hit me. He's like, wham! Hit me again. Oh, and he like almost broke ribs. So I don't know if he does that illustration much. But that's what it's like with God. Nobody can hit God. He will hold them in derision. They thought they were doing something awesome at the Tower of Babel, but they didn't hold a candle to God's power, and he just came and thwarted it. They had unity, but it was not a unity that pleased God. God is only pleased with unity that's according to truth. Look at, this is our verse for the week. You can look at your bulletin or turn to Proverbs 16 and verse 5. Proverbs 16, 5. Whenever we go into an endeavor, we're going to transition to our next point with this thought too. Whenever we go into an endeavor, we need to ask ourselves this question. Does this please God, what I'm doing? Because if it doesn't, it doesn't matter what the polls say. It doesn't matter how popular this is. People that live by the polls are very fickle. It's like they turn on the news today and they say, what am I going to believe today? You know, tell me what everyone else believes and I'll tell you what I believe. That's how many people, that's why they use polls. Because polls, they don't just tell what public opinion is. Polls sway public opinion because people are sheep. And they say, if that many people believe that, that many people can't be wrong. That's flawed thinking. So here's what Proverbs 16:5 says. It says, everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Though hand join in hand, he shall not be unpunished. If there's pride involved, if there's something that displeases God, you can have the whole world go that way, but God will still bring them down. You can have millions or billions of people, and unity, not only doesn't it automatically please God, but unity cannot overthrow God. You and God are a majority. And if you want to be safe, you just find out what God says in the Bible and you go with that. And sometimes you have to make a choice. That's why the Bible says this. That when you become a Christian, sometimes you have to make a choice. He that cometh after me and hateth not his father and mother and his children and so forth. Sometimes you have to walk away from an entire family in order to please God. It doesn't mean that you hate your family, it means that if your family hates God, we have to choose God over our family. Don't go to hell for anyone. I know a lot of people that, because their family is so entrenched in this view, they say, well, I don't want to go against my family. So in so many words, they say this: I guess I'll just go to hell with my family because I don't want to displease my family. That's the wrong attitude to have. We are called to come apart from unity if unity is against God, because God will bring it down. Number three, third thought we see in Genesis 11, look at verse 7, is that we see the vanity. We kind of hinted at this already. We see the vanity of excluding God. You make plans without God, you're just going to spin your wheels, or even worse. It's a worthless endeavor in life to have your plans and your goals and your agenda be the opposite of what God wants. It's a worthless life, a worthless existence. So look at Genesis 11, verse 7. So we already saw their attitude, the rebellion against God. And God says, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Look at the very end of verse 4 and then the very end of verse 9. It's almost kind of comical, but it's ironic. Genesis 11, the end of verse 4 says this: let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And then look at the end of verse 9. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Let's do this so we don't get scattered. And God did the exact same thing that they didn't want to happen, because they made plans without God. If you make plans without God, the exact opposite of what you want to happen will often happen. If I can put it this way, God will make your worst nightmares come true. If we exclude God from our lives, you say, I want to live my life, and the only thing I don't want is this. God will make it come to pass often that our greatest fears are what comes upon us. Ezekiel, won't turn there for sake of time, listen to this. Ezekiel 11, verse 8. It says, ye have feared the sword, and I will bring a sword upon you, saith the Lord God. And when we reject God in our life, the thing that we don't want to happen, God will often allow it to come. Look at Psalm 127, verse 1. Here's a great principle. You apply this in your house, in your family. You apply this in a church. You can apply this with a physical building. You can apply this with a life dream and agenda. This is a really important principle in life, that we can't fight against God. Psalm 127, verse 1 says this: except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. Two things there. If you want to build something, and then if you want to protect something that's already there, if God is not in it, you're wasting your time. You can get the greatest security system known to man, but if it's against God, God can allow someone to break in. You can get the greatest architects and the greatest number of people and the greatest strategy. And that's what they had at the Tower of Babel. But if God does not want that to be built, it will not be built. So if we are striking out in our lives with plans that don't acknowledge God, we're wasting our time. That God, if he wants to, can bring our plans to zero in a second. God did this fast. This is like one day. One day the tower and the city are going forward. The next day, it's done. They couldn't even give me a hammer. ¿Por qué? You know, no, they couldn't send anything. In 1 second, God brought their plans to nothing. They couldn't even, now they're spending all their time trying to find somebody. Do you speak Sumerian? They couldn't even find somebody. Eventually, they kind of found somebody that they can communicate with, and they'd go off somewhere else. But God confounded their plans because their plans didn't involve God. Look at Haggai 1 in verse 6. Maybe you've been at this point in your life. I've been at this point in my life of Haggai 1 and verse 6. Sometimes people don't put two and two together. They don't see the cause and effect of the direction of my life with the way things are turning out. Look at Haggai 1 and verse 6. It says this: ye have sown much and bring in little. That doesn't make sense. Bible says you sow, you reap what you sow, right? So if I sow a lot of seed, then I should be bringing in a lot of harvest. But these people are against God in their lives. You have so much and bring in little. You eat, but you don't have enough. You drink, but you aren't filled with drink. They clothe themselves, but no one is warm. And he that earneth wages to put them into a bag with holes in it. Ever been there where it seems like, I always often think about the cartoon where Yosemite Sam or someone, he's carrying gunpowder, but somebody's poked a hole and he's like sneaking off and the gunpowder's trailing off behind him. And then once he gets there, somebody lights a fuse and the gunpowder follows him and explodes and he dies. No, he doesn't die because you don't die in cartoons. But he comes back in the next scene and he has a new plan. That's what it's like. People, they go to work and they got a bag. Okay, I've got $3 million. And by the time they tiptoe home, the money's gone. How did that happen? I had a flat tire and this went wrong and that went wrong. And God has a way. By the way, I'm not going to broad stroke it. And just because sometimes money is tight doesn't automatically mean God is against you. Okay, we're not talking health and wealth, prosperity, gospel. But this is the possibility sometimes, is that if you live your life against God, you can go make a lot of money and God can bring it down. God can bring it to naught. And the first thing we should always think if we perceive we're in that situation is, am I living against God? Is there something in my life that doesn't please God? Is there something in my life that I'm not acknowledging God? I need to make sure that my life with God is right. And then maybe that's not it. Maybe God's trying to redirect me. Maybe I'm doing something good, but God wants me to do something better. You know, but we need to be sensitive to this truth that a life without God is futile. And God wants us, because he knows what's best for us, he does this to get our attention. On the other side, if we acknowledge God, he can open doors for us that we couldn't even imagine to be open. And he can close doors that we couldn't have even closed on our own. If you live your life, this is a potential. If you live your life with God, again, we're not talking health and wealth, prosperity, that if you follow God, you'll never have another problem in your whole life. You know, we're not talking about that. But here's what Psalm 37:5 says. Commit thy way unto the Lord, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. It's a good Bible principle that if you give your way to God, God, I don't know what to do, but in my life, it's like giving God a blank check. I signed it and you put anything you want on this. You run my life. God says, if you commit your way into the Lord and trust in him, he will bring it to pass. God can do amazing things in your life. I want to balance this real fast. There are times that people exclude God and they make plans without God and it works. And that can be the worst possible thing also. Real fast, I'm trying to decide if we want to turn to these. But since you guys are listening so well, we'll go ahead and turn there. Look at Psalm 106 in verse 13. Two examples of this. The nation of Israel, when they were out in the wilderness, they were not walking with God. And they prayed one day, and they got what they wanted, and it was the worst thing they could have gotten. You think if God answers your prayer, that must mean that he is pleased with you, and he answers your prayer. There are sometimes when God, quote-unquote, answers our prayers and allows our pushing through the door to happen, and it's bad. So here's one example, Psalm 106, verse 13. It says, they soon forgat his works. They waited not for his counsel, but lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert. And he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. This has to do with, they said, we don't like this manna, we need flesh. And God gave them the quail, he gave them flesh to eat. But while they were eating it, many of them died on the spot. And he gave them what they demanded, but then he sent leanness into their souls, and they were worse off. It was the worst thing that could have happened. So be careful about pushing through. Here's often the way we live life. What do I want? I want this. This is what I want. You know, God bless this. You bless this. Give me this. This is the only thing I want. Instead of acknowledging him. And sometimes God will say, okay, there you go. You can have it. And our souls depart from him. Here's another example. Look at 1 Samuel 8. The nation of Israel wanted a king one day. They didn't want Samuel. They didn't want God to rule over them anymore. They said, we want to be like all the other nations. Give us a king so we can be like the world. And God finally said, all right, here's your king. But he told Samuel this. Go tell them what the king is going to be like. It's actually going to be a judgment. He's going to take away your lands. He's going to take away your children. He's going to tax you. It's going to be oppressive. By the way, when he told them that, they said, don't care. Give us a king. Look at 1 Samuel 2 verses, 1 Samuel 8 verse 9 and then verse 18. 1 Samuel 8:9. It says, now therefore hearken, unto their voice. They want a king? Give them a king. Howbeit, yet protest solemnly unto them and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. It's not going to be good. And then look down at verse 18. It says, and ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. God, quote unquote, heard them. He gave them their prayer requests, but he said, it's going to be bad, and it's going to get so bad that one day you will cry out, and I will not hear you because you've rejected me. You only wanted what you wanted. So you can't say, if the things that I want in life are coming to pass, then it must be that God is pleased with me and God is for me. Can't say that. We need to take a step back and say, God, I want my life to be ordered by you. If my will is not the right thing, I want you to cut it off. I want you to bring it to nothing so that I can have your will. And I want to end with this. Number four is I want to look at that angle of it. The mercy of God's judgment. Sometimes God thwarts our plans, and it's the best thing that could ever happen. That's what part of what happened at the Tower of Babel. By the way, did anybody die at the Tower of Babel? No. God went down and he confounded their language so that they would spread out. They had their plan, and God brought it to naught, but he didn't harm them. God didn't, on the one hand, it's a judgment that he judged their plans, but on the other hand, he showed them a mercy. He didn't force them, but he directed them into the keeping of his will, even though it's not what they wanted. God wanted them to spread out, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth, fill the earth. And they said, let's build a tower so they don't get scattered. And God says, no, my will is for you to be scattered, to spread out. And so God did that for them. And God brought them judgment. But I want to look at the mercy sometimes of God's judgment. Often, you ever been there where you had something that you were planning to do? You had your thing you were doing this day, and it's like nothing would, come on, the computer's not working, it's got to be faster, come on, red light, I got to get there. And sometimes God will put something in your path. Sometimes God will even have you be in a car accident or give you a flat tire or something like that to derail your plans. And I can remember places in my life where I see God putting roadblocks and I'm trying to climb over them. I'm like, come on, this is awful. And God's just trying to keep me from myself. Sometimes God will bring sometimes they'll put you in the hospital on your back for a while. It makes you think about, like, go to your room and sit there and think about what you're doing for a while. And God, and you think, oh, this is the worst thing ever. I'm missing out on this game or I'm missing out on this activity. And sometimes that could be the very best thing that ever happens to you in your whole life. Sometimes it can be a life-changing moment that at the moment we thought was bad, but it's God trying to get our attention. I know about people that have been involved in certain things, not necessarily sinful or wrong, but God brought for instance, they were involved in a certain sport, and they were really good at it. They're a professional athlete, and God put an end to that with a career-ending injury, and he called them to ministry. And they testify, it was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, this career-ending injury, because I was going my way without God. And sometimes God's judgment is a mercy to us to keep us from ourselves. Look at Proverbs 3 and verse 11. Proverbs 3, verse 11. And then we'll turn, I want to look back at Daniel 4. We looked at Daniel 4 with Nebuchadnezzar. I want to go back to it in just a second. So Proverbs 3 verse 11 says this, my son, despise not the chastening of the Lord. You know why God tells us not to despise his chastening? Because we despise his chastening. Whenever God chastens us, we hate it. We don't think, yay, this is the best day of my life. God is chastening me. High five, this is awesome. We don't do that. We despise it. We wish it would go away. But it says, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father the son in whom he delighteth. When a son is disciplined for something that he's done wrong, he doesn't usually have the foresight to thank his father on the spot. It's awful. But hopefully he grows, and in hindsight he can say, thank you for doing that. Thank you for keeping me from myself. Look at Daniel chapter 4 and verse 37. What God did to Nebuchadnezzar in his pride, he brought him low. Some people would turn away from that and say, I never want anything to do with God the rest of my life. But if we will listen to God's judgment, it can be the best thing ever. And Nebuchadnezzar learned a wonderful lesson. By this testimony, I believe Nebuchadnezzar is in heaven today. I believe that he believed in God and became a believer and if he's in heaven, this was definitely the best thing God could have ever done to his life, is put him on all fours for 7 years. So look at Daniel 4, verse 34. It says, "And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me. And I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing." And here's a great verse about the sovereignty of God. "And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou?" If God's going to do something, he does it and that's it. Nobody can stop it. "At the same time, my reason returned unto me. And for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me. And my counselors and my lords sought unto me." That's kind of astonishing. Why would anyone ever come back and ask advice of a guy that spent 7 years eating grass like an ox? You'd say, "I'm done with asking him for wisdom." But God gave it back. God restored it. And it says, "And I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Now," this is the end of the story, "now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase." By the way, Daniel chapter 4 is Nebuchadnezzar writing, if you look at the beginning of the chapter, he's writing a letter to the whole world. That's what it says. He's the king of the Babylonian Empire that spreads out over much of the known world, and he writes this letter and he says, "I want you to let everyone hear this. This is my testimony now. I rebelled against God. I lifted myself up and God humbled me. But God brought me back, and I praise and extol." He wanted the whole world to know. This is a pretty awesome chapter. And God's judgment in your life can be the very best thing that ever happens if you respond right to it. It can end in salvation. People, they shake their fists against God. They don't know God. They fight against God. "Maybe he's there, but I hate him." And then God brings a severe judgment. And some people could say, "Oh, he hates me. I hate him back." Or some could say, "He's trying to reach out and get my attention. And you have my attention. And now I believe in you, and I humble myself, and I'm done with my pride, and I praise and extol and honor." How many ways could Nebuchadnezzar say that God is awesome here? And it's just a wonderful passage that we can share with the world. Can you imagine, could anyone have imagined Nebuchadnezzar saying these things about God before what he went through? I'm sure people wrote him off as a lost cause. If there's anyone that will never get saved, it's Nebuchadnezzar. Look what he has. And he's in rebellion against God. And there's no way God's ever going to reach out to him or he's ever going to believe in God. And in 7 years, he's one of the greatest believers you can imagine, writing a letter to the whole world praising God. God has a way of turning the hearts of unbelievers. We need to never, if you're sharing the gospel with somebody, remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar. No matter how hardened, how far they are from God, God could turn them around in a second. But it takes their cooperation. They have to bow and yield and believe in him. Can you look back in your life and see the things that God has done? See times where you realize God was chastening me. God was trying to get my attention. God was judging me. And I thank God for what he did. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't say, "Oh man, I missed out on 7 years. Can you imagine how rich I'd be if I had that extra 7 years to gather wealth?" He didn't do that. He said, "That was the best 7 years of my whole life. Put me on my knees." I want to finish with this verse, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. It says, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths." Are you acknowledging God in all of your ways? Not some. And I have to ask myself this question too, because life is complicated, right? We wear a lot of hats and we do a lot of things. Are we acknowledging God in all of our ways? The Tower of Babel was the epitome of man not acknowledging God. We don't need God. We want to lift ourselves up against God. And God shut it down, brought it to nothing. Nebuchadnezzar didn't acknowledge God. He says, "Look at what I have built." And God shut it down. How about our lives? Are we building an empire, so to speak? Do we have a goal, a dream, or agenda that we probably don't run it by God because I don't think he'd be pleased with it? Or it's okay, God might be pleased with it, but just in case he's not pleased with it, I need to double down on it. Can you say that every area of your life is under God's leadership? That I acknowledge Him. I say, you give me wisdom. If you don't want me to do this, shut it down now. Is that our attitude? Or do you want God to bless the work of our own hands? The Tower of Babel should stand as an everlasting monument to us in our hearts that life without God is futile, that He will shut it down. But life with God, there's joy and there's blessing, there's fulfillment because I'm doing God's will. What greater joy in the whole life to know that the God of the whole universe that made me, I'm doing what He wants me to do and He's pleased with me and He's going to bless me. It's really simple. It's freeing because life is so complicated, but we just give it to God and let Him do what He wants to with our lives. Let's close together in prayer.